Class is back in session. It's time for Baptist Basics University from BaptistBasics.org. That's right. It's time once again for Baptist Basics University. I am Matthew Gage. This will be lesson number 23. We're finally making some ground up. Lesson number 23 in our series on the book of Acts. We will be in chapter 17 and covering the entire chapter, 1 through 34. And title of today's lesson is The Second Missionary Journey, Part 3. And we have today's lesson and the next, and we'll be wrapping up the second missionary journey of Paul. And then we jump right into the third missionary journey. So, but anyway, when we last left Paul, he was in Philippi. And we talked quite a bit about what happened there. In fact, we're probably going to, because of the story and stuff, we dwelt a lot more on the history and stuff there than we're going to probably from here out. But the story really lent itself to it. In today's lesson, Paul's going to continue traveling down south and going down into mainland Greece. And he will visit today Thessalonica. He will also visit Athens, and we will close today, and in fact, close the chapter there with Paul's sermon on Mars Hill, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. But we will see here, we will see in this story that more about kind of the clash of the cultures and clash of thought that Paul was dealing with. We're going to see Paul as a Jew receive trouble from Jews. We're going to see him try to explain Christianity to the leading Greek philosophers of the time. So there's quite a bit of stuff that happens in this. It's a lot of action-packed excitement. But we'll just kind of jump right in and say one of the things to keep in mind is just that as Paul's missionary journey reaching areas that it appears really haven't had the gospel preached to them. At least no one of the stature of Paul or an apostle has been to these areas. And as he's going in, I mean, he is a pioneer. He is a trailblazer going into these areas. In fact, Paul, you know, later would write that, you know, he preferred not to build on another man's work. And that is what he is doing here. He is going really, he's going to end up right in the heart of the Greek world with all its philosophy and its thought and its science. And it seems like the whole Mediterranean world looked to Greece and looked up to their thought and their logic. And here is Paul going to be right in the middle of it all. In fact, right at the very center of thought at Mars Hill, proclaiming Christianity, and really doing it in an amazing way. He doesn't, it's very interesting that when he doesn't, we'll get into this, but he doesn't just go, bless God, it says right here in the Bible. He really goes to explain it using their own logic. It is an amazing deal, an amazing study in how he does that. So, but anyway, where we last left Paul, of course, they were in Philippi. They have left there. You know, of course, we talked quite a bit about that, how they left and how kind of humorous a situation it was. But they left town. They headed towards Thessalonica. So once again, I'm going to recommend, and I think I do this in just about every lesson that involves Paul's missionary journeys, but I'm going to recommend that you do look up and get a map to look at in this. In fact, I'm bringing mine back up as we speak so I can kind of help explain this. But having a map will be a tremendous help to you as you see some of this. Philippi, mainland Greece, is kind of up northeast, kind of the northeast side of Greece. And Paul is going to begin traveling west and then turn south and end up in Athens. But of course, it's going to be just a little bit before he actually ends up in Athens. We've got to cover what happens in Thessalonica and Berea before we get there. And really, this is one of those lessons I don't really have a really good introduction for. Now, boy, have I been rambling, and this has been rough. I really thought I did a pretty good job in the last lesson. This one has been rough. But so anyway, we'll just go right on ahead and we'll jump in. As we begin the setting, of course, we are in route from Philippi. He's headed to Thessalonica. Remind you again that the second missionary journey takes place sometime between the years 49 and 52 AD. So probably by this point, we're probably 50-51 AD. So let's begin chapter 17, verse 1. Now, when they had passed, notice we talked about that, how Luke stayed in Philippi. That's why the pronoun changed there. So when they had passed through Amphipolis and Apollonia, they came to Thessalonica, where there was a synagogue of the Jews. So basically what's happening here, Paul has traveled along a road called the Via Ignatia. It's a major, major trade route. It's the trade from the eastern part of the empire would come through here and be hauled across the northern part of Greece. So this is a major, major road. They would go across Greece, load the stuff back up in a ship, and sail across into Italy. And these towns are along this road, this trade route. Amphipolis is an important city on the route. Apollonia is kind of halfway in between Amphipolis and Thessalonica. You can look this up as you see. Thessalonica itself is a port city. It is a major trade hub because, you know, ships could come in off this route and then sail down the coast to Athens. The trade going east to west could turn south there. It is one of the biggest towns, one of the biggest, most important towns on this trade route. So it's another place you can look up and see some nice pictures of some ruins if you want to. So verse 2. We've already said there's a synagogue of the Jews there, so there is a Jewish presence, a Jewish population there. Verse 2. And Paul, as his manner was, went in unto them, and three Sabbath days reasoned with them out of the Scripture. So for 3 weeks he has been trying to preach Christ to them. And what's he been doing? Verse 3. Opening and alleging that Christ must needs have suffered and risen again from the dead, and that this Jesus, whom I preach unto you, is Christ. It's very interesting there, just the language there. I want to point this out because it goes from talking about Paul was doing this to that I preach unto you. So is he quoting Paul, or is Luke going into the first person trying to say, hey, Theophilus, that I wrote this book to you, I'm telling you he was doing what I'm trying to tell you, what I'm trying to preach to you too. Kind of interesting. I don't completely know why it changes there. But it's very interesting. I think it's funny. So we see that he has been trying to prove from the Old Testament. He's been going out and alleging, you know, so this is kind of a debate that's been going on. He's saying, well, you know, what about this verse? And what about that? No, you think that, well, what about this? And so there's been this debate going on for 3 weeks. He's been trying to lay the groundwork, for the gospel. And verse 4, we see that he does have some fruit in his labors, and some of them believed and consorted, I like that word, consorted, with Paul and Silas, and of the devout Greeks, a great multitude, and of the chief women, not a few. So really, Paul has been very successful. We have some Jewish people be saved. We have some Gentile proselytes be saved. And who the chief women are, I don't really understand who they are, but they were very important women, evidently. You know, they were heads of their Indian tribes. No, I'm just kidding. That's a very bad joke. I'm really struggling so bad I'm making up bad jokes. But anyway, so we see that there are quite a few people that have been saved. So as Paul has been giving this logical presentation of the Bible, and proving Christ's ministry, Christ's death, you know, and the gospel, there's fruit, people are being saved. We know from every other place Paul's been, when people get saved, what follows? Trouble. That's what's going to happen. Verse 5. But the Jews, which believed not, moved with envy. I like it. It's not hate. They're envious. They're like, boy, we wish we had those people following us. Took unto them certain lewd fellows of the baser sort. That's such a wordy way of saying that these were just bad guys. These were lowlifes. These were scumbags. And gathered a company and set all the city on an uproar and assaulted the house of Jason and sought to bring them out to the people. So basically they start a riot in Thessalonica to try to get rid of Paul and Silas. Who did it? The Jews. Perhaps they see how persuasive he is, and they see that their own numbers are dwindling, and more people are believing, Paul's doctrines. But they basically do some of the most underhanded tactics here imaginable, and it's so funny. These people who claim to be so moral and claim to be so virtuous and religious. Paul just brings out the worst in them. We had the, what was it there in the, we had that just last lesson or lesson ago. Oh yeah. It was the people that had the slave girl who was demon possessed. That was a fortune teller, and how, when they were charging Paul, it's like, you know, we Romans can't do what they're doing, but boy, they didn't have any problem, you know, taking advantage of a slave girl and fortune-telling stuff, which, you know, that kind of goes along with the morals of the time. But as I say, they're kind of picking and choosing their morals. And here we go. These Jews are so desperate to get rid of Paul. They can't beat him at his own game. They can't prove him wrong because he's right. So what do? They go and make a deal with a bunch of lowlife, probably criminals. Think hoodlums here. To get rid of them, and they start a riot, and they assault the house of Jason, and they're wanting to bring them out and tear them to shreds. So verse 6, and when they found them not, they bust in this man Jason's house, and Paul and Silas aren't there. It says they drew Jason and certain brethren unto the rulers of the city, crying, these that have turned the world upside down are come hither also. So Poor Jason and these guys are there. They're just Christians. They're minding their own business. And suddenly there's a riot outside. They're looking. They're out for blood. And Jason and these guys just happen to be there. So they drag them to the rulers of the city. And basically they're saying, look, these troublemakers, they have been causing trouble everywhere else. And now here they are again. It says, verse 7, whom Jason hath received, and these do, contrary to the decrees of Caesar, saying that there is another king, one Jesus. So, boy, they've got him worked up saying, you know, and what is even funnier about this is that the Greek people really kind of just tolerated the Romans. They really didn't like them. In fact, basically the only way Rome got control of Greece was through a whole lot of fighting and some pretty major bloodbath that took place, because the Greeks were pretty fiercely independent. So for them to suddenly say, boy, we like Caesar, that's almost comical in a sense. But that's just them wanting to get rid of Paul. They'll stoop to any level and claim anything to get rid of Paul. So, of course, now saying that there's another king, one Jesus. Okay, this is a corruption of what they were actually teaching. Is it really that much different than what the Jews believe? That the Jews really had issues with Rome because they refused to worship the emperors. And basically, that's kind of what they're doing here, is a similar thing. They're saying, well, you know, even though the Jews kind of got away with it, these Christians, they can't get away with it. Boy, they're saying that this Jesus is more important than Caesar. Well, the Jews basically did the same thing, but they're not getting hauled in front of people. So verse 8, and they troubled the people and the rulers of the city when they heard these things. So, you know, boy, they've got everybody upset. They've even got the rulers upset. Verse 9, and when they had taken security of Jason and of the other, they let them go. So, So basically, you know, the crowd's dispersed. They didn't get who they want, but boy, they are upset. The whole town is upset, and they are out for Paul and Silas. Now, they kind of let Jason and everybody else kind of go free because these weren't the men they wanted, but boy, are they upset, and is it not a good time to be a Christian and not a good time to be around Paul and Silas? So verse 10, what's going to happen? Say, isn't it funny how it happens? People get saved, trouble comes, and Paul gets run out of town. It just happened again. Except this time, basically, they're getting Paul out of town for his own safety. Verse 10, and the brethren immediately sent away Paul and Silas by night unto Berea, who coming thither went into the synagogue of the Jews. Now, Berea is a small town. It's west of Thessalonica. It's off the trade routes. It's kind of, I don't want to call it backwoods, but it's definitely off the beaten path, per se. And it's actually kind of, I believe it's across a mountain range, if I remember right. And so they're kind of going up in the hills. They're getting out of the main cities in doing this. So Berea is a great place to hide out. They can go there, and there's not a whole lot of traffic, not a whole lot of messengers going through. So it's a good place for them to hide out. And of course, what did Paul do when he gets there? They immediately go right back to the synagogue of Jews. Does it stop them? Does all this trouble ever stop Paul? No. They just go to a new city and repeat the same process. And so here they are again. They're in the synagogue. Verse 11. These were more noble, this talking about the Jews, were more noble than those in Thessalonica, in that they received the word with all readiness of mind and searched the scriptures daily whether these things were so. Now, it's funny. Paul was just, it appears, in Thessalonica, talked to him that he was there three Sabbath days. So 3 weeks, in 3 weeks, on three Sabbaths, 3 days. But yet these guys are so interested and so taken by it, these Jews at this synagogue, that every day the debate's going. And boy, they are searching the scriptures out and debating this and trying to really seek out the truth. And that's why this verse, if you've seen, I know there's you know, colleges and at least one college I know of, and churches and different things, they're named after Berea. And it's because of how Luke describes them and how that they were noble and they searched the scriptures, really wanting to know the truth. And that's a good thing. That's something we as Christians even ought to do. We ought to be of a noble character, that we ought to be searching out the scriptures for the truth. That, you know, that's the way we ought to be living also. And here are these Jews doing that. So verse 12, therefore many of them believe, which of course, yes, if you study out the Bible, yes, it proves that Jesus was God. It proves salvation by grace through faith. It's there. The problem with the Jews at the time and even today is they refuse to accept their own word. They don't read it. They don't study it. It's crazy. In Jewish ceremonies and stuff, they will skip over passages like Isaiah 53 that really strongly point to Christ in his ministry and his sacrifice. They will, you know, say they will read Isaiah 52 and Isaiah 54, but they don't read Isaiah 53. And, you know, it's amazing how they just kind of skip over stuff like that. And I've heard, and say, am I a Jew? No, I'm not. But I have heard Jewish people that became Christians say that. They would say, they would go to the rabbis and say, hey, who's this talking about? And the rabbi's like, I don't know. I've never read that part. You know, because it's not part of our liturgy, you know, or whatever you want to call it, that they use in their ceremonies. So anyway, but like I said, if you study out the Bible, if you take it and you read it literally, and you let the word speak and not your own opinions and your own prejudices, you have to come to the point to see that of salvation by grace through faith. You have to come to the point of the deity of Christ. If you do not see those things, you're not reading the Bible right. I'm just put it point blank. You're letting your own prejudices influence the way you're reading it, because those things are so clear and so concrete in the Bible. And what's amazing that scripture they're searching, that's not Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and Romans, and you know, it's not the New Testament. That's the Old Testament they're able to do this from. They'll say passages, you know, perhaps, you know, Psalm 23, Isaiah 53. Well, Psalm 23 may not be a good one, but Isaiah 53, for example, and plenty of Psalms. But Isaiah 53, for example, when it talks about, you know, the servant suffering and bearing the sin of many and stuff like that, who else could it talk about? It couldn't talk about a prophet or anybody. It's talking about Jesus. And when you real, I mean, it is so clear, at least to me, and I'll say other people may read it differently, but to me, if you let the Bible speak for itself, you have to believe the fundamental doctrines of the Christian faith. So, boy, where were they? Verse 12, men believing also of honorable women, which were Greeks, and of men, not a few. So a whole bunch of people get saved. So boy, revivals going on, which means trouble follows. Verse 13, but when the Jews of Thessalonica had knowledge that the word of God was preached of Paul at Berea, they came thither also and stirred up the people. So the Jews at Thessalonica said, boy, we got rid of them here. Now they're over there causing trouble. Let's run them out from over there too. So that's what they do. They go over there, run them out of town too. And verse 14. And then immediately the brethren sent away Paul to go, as it were, to the sea. But Silas and Timotheus abode there still. So this is really kind of funny. It's like they're really kind of secretly trying to get Paul out of town. I don't know what it is about these Jews at Thessalonica, but the church is scared of them. We keep seeing the brethren, that's talking about the church members. They are really scared of those Jews at Thessalonica. Perhaps it was because of how they started the riot. I don't know what, but they are scared of these guys. Normally, Paul would just leave town, go on to the next town. But in this case, they are actually trying to sneak him out of town. And it says there is to go, as it were, by sea. So they are like going to sneak him out of town, put him on the boat, and get him out of town. But Silas and Timothy are going to stay there. So I guess maybe to trick people into thinking they're still there. You know, if it was so bad, why are they still there? You know, why didn't they get out of town too? But they're sneaking out Paul, as, you know, quietly. So evidently, I mean, it's pretty ugly. These Jews from Thessalonica are well, they play dirty, evidently, because we see what they're doing for Paul safely. So here we go. Verse 15. And they that conducted Paul, I like it. It's not, you know, Paul went. It's they that conducted Paul. So, I mean, they've like got him in hiding, and they've got him under guard. Brought him unto Athens, and receiving a commandment unto Silas and Timotheus for to come to him with all speed, they departed. So basically, they get him to Athens, say, boy, you'll be safe. You're far enough away down here. It's a huge city. You can hide. And Paul says, okay, great. Thanks. I'll be fine, guys. Go back and get Silas and Timothy and bring them down here. So here's Paul, evidently by himself, dumped out in Athens. Which, of course, you ought to recognize Athens. It became the leading Greek city, you know, famous for its battles with Sparta and the other, you know, city-states. But Athens became the leading city, Greek city, culturally, financially, philosophically. This is the center of Greece. And now, by this time, it had really lost a lot of its luster. A lot of the buildings were in disrepair. We find like Nero actually went over there and was paying to rebuild a lot of stuff because he'd heard how great it was, goes over there and it's like, wow, this place is a dump. These buildings are falling apart. So he's even helped, you know, to rebuild a lot of the stuff and kind of try to return it to its former glory. But even still, even though maybe some of the buildings are kind of old and dilapidated, even though it's not as powerful a city or as populous as Rome or Alexandria or Antioch, it's still, because of the Greek culture, it is still a very important city. And let's say the center of the Greek culture is Athens. So here's Paul now in the middle of the Gentile world, maybe not politically, but at least culturally and philosophically, he is in the middle of the Gentile world. The leading spokesman for Christianity is now in the middle of the Gentile world. So verse 16. Now while Paul waited for them at Athens, his spirit was stirred in him when he saw the city wholly given to idolatry. So evidently there is no Jewish population here. He's able to look out, you know, and you actually go up to the Acropolis there in Athens and look out across this great metropolitan area, which is still a very large city in the Roman Empire, and look out and realize, Paul's looking out there and realizing, you know what, I am probably the only Christian here. Tens of thousands, I don't know, maybe hundreds of thousands, I'm not sure what the population was, but Paul's sitting there, and I think the thought occurs to him, I'm the only person that has the truth. And no one else out there does. It kind of reminds me of David Livingstone being moved when he heard a missionary to Africa say, you know, that at night you could see the campfires of thousands of villages that had not been reached with the gospel, and how that so moved his heart and motivated him. I think that's very similar to what Paul had here. As he looks out across there, he knows all about Athens. He knows all about the Greek culture. He knows all about the schools of philosophy that take place there. He knows all of the legends and the stories. And here he is, and in spite of the reputation and the prominence of this place, he very likely is the only Christian, the only person who is saved in the entire city. And it so moves his heart. So verse 17, therefore, disputed he in the synagogue with the Jews and with the devout persons in the market daily with them that met him. So goes right to work. He's there trying to reach the Jews, the devout persons. Now, the devout persons, basically, that's people who are worshiping. We see this quite a bit, the honorable women, the devout persons. What these appear to be are like Jewish proselytes. These are Gentile people worshiping the Jewish God, and we see this happen quite a bit. And I believe I've talked at length about that. So, but that's who those people were. And it says, it's interesting. He's in the market daily. So he's taking this thing public. He's not just preaching on the Sabbath days. And he's not just going around, you know, visiting the contacts. He is right in the middle of the city in the hustle and bustle, trying to preach the gospel and trying to teach. And this is something what he's doing in Athens is he's doing what the philosophers would do, you know, and set up shop and try to preach the gospel. It reminds me, I'm getting a lot of missionary stuff. It reminds me, this is something Adoniram Judson did when he was in Burma, is he ended up, you know, setting up a little house, and basically it was kind of like a philosophical school is how he did it, where he would teach the gospel and teach about the Bible and stuff. But how he approached it was not, I'm going to build a church and boy, they'll just come to me because church. He was trying to reach them in their way and was, you know, setting up this little, I can't remember what he called it. By the way, Adoniram Judson, if you want to read a very well done biography of him, On the Golden Shore. I don't remember the lady who wrote it, but it's very good. But that's one of the things that he did. And so, you know, say Paul's doing that. He's setting up, basically following what the philosophers would do, because hey, that's how you get a crowd. That's how you get your message out, and it's very customary. There's tons of philosophers and teachers in Athens doing this very same thing. So it's not conspicuous, and it goes right along with what the locals are doing. In fact, we see that he already has inroads with the philosophers and thinkers there in Athens. Verse 18, then certain philosophers of the Epicureans and of the Stoics encountered him. And some said, what will this babbler say? So like, what's this crazy man going to say? Other some was what they're saying. Well, it's kind of weird the way I split that up. But other people, basically other some, he seemeth to be a setter forth of strange gods because he preaches unto them Jesus and the resurrection. So, word's getting around about what he's preaching. It's reaching up into the schools of philosophy there. Now, just a little side note. Let me explain what these are. If I'm going to try to, because philosophy is one of those things I appreciate to an extent. and I understand a little bit of it, but there comes a point to where it just does not make sense to me. And I am basically going to read you some definitions that I came up with on these. It's actually from a philosophical website talking about the history of philosophy and stuff. And you can study these things out if you want to, but I'm just going to kind of give you a definition and hope it makes sense to you, because these schools of thought were very prominent at the time, but it really gets kind of sticky even in some of the dividing points. So first of all, we have Epicureanism, I'm giving you this quote. It teaches that the greatest good is to seek modest pleasures in order to attain a state of tranquility, freedom from fear, and absence from bodily pain. So basically, it's, you know, just a simple lifestyle, reaching, you know, tranquility and peace, and you don't have fear and you don't have pain. You're just there. I kind of get a transcendental type vibe to it, but I don't think that's necessarily the case. And then you had their debate partners. You had the Stoics, and Stoicism. It teaches the development, and this quote I'm quoting again, teaches the development of self-control and fortitude as a means of overcoming destructive emotions. So basically, it's preaching self-control and fortitude. You know, that one, Epicurean, you don't hear as much of anymore. You do hear the word Stoic used sometimes, especially in sports. He's a Stoic competitor playing through pain, you know, and stuff like that. So anyway, if you want to do some more research on those, it really doesn't have a lot of bearing on the story, but I just want to explain who they were and kind of what they believed. And I don't want to go too deep in their history. You can do that on your own. So verse 19, and they took him and brought him unto Areopagus, and I'm probably butchering the Greek pronunciation on that. That is Mars Hill, if you want to translate. In fact, it translates Mars Hill. Ares is the Greek form of the god Mars, and Pagus means hill. Okay, so Mars Hill, saying, May we know what this new doctrine whereof thou speakest is. So, like, hey, why don't you come up here and join us? We really want to know about this. So, boy, I mean, what a ticket this is, you would think, for somebody. If Paul had any earthly ambition, boy, this would have been one of the highlights. He's a Jew from the outer reaches of the empire, and here he is amongst the leading thinkers of the empire at Mars Hill. He's been invited to speak before them. And does Paul ever turn down an opportunity to preach? Absolutely not. And he's going to take this one. So, here I go. I'm getting ahead of myself. They're continuing with the invitation, verse 20. For thou bringest certain strange things to our ears. We've never heard this before. We would know, therefore, what these things mean. So verse 21, for all the Athenians and strangers which were there spent their time in nothing else but either to tell or to hear some new thing. So basically, the people there and these thinkers, they just lived for philosophy and to hear a new idea. It really, boy, this reminds me, I'm getting so many sidetrack things on this one, but this reminds me of the way France got with the I can't even say it, but when they got so wrapped up in philosophy and really got into some really crazy stuff, but it really got in, because it's like, you know, the hottest person was a guy with a new idea, and they didn't want anything new or old. They wanted everything. What's the new thing? What's the new idea? And if you couldn't even keep new jokes coming, if you could not stay witty in your conversation, you were old hat and cast aside, and it was just a fleeting popularity that they had. And I sense something similar here with the state of the people of Athens, is that they were, you know, just all about these, or at least these philosophers were all about, let's just learn something new, and then we'll debate it on its merit, and we'll debate it according to our schools of belief. So, verse 22, Then Paul stood in the midst of Mars Hill, which is very, this is very interesting. I think, you know, why did they translate Mars Hill down here and they didn't up in verse 19? But anyway, Mars Hill and said, "Ye men of Athens, I perceive that in all things ye are too superstitious." As I say, some newer translations of the Bible take superstition and replace it with religious or something like that. Superstition, it seems like I just covered this, has a certain meaning and connotation in the Roman Greek world, and it speaks kind of religion that is kind of above and beyond and not quite completely approved of. So basically what he's saying is, look, you guys are taking religion to a little bit too far. So verse 23, "For as I passed by and beheld your devotions," that's their religious ceremonies and stuff, "I found an altar with this inscription, to the unknown God, whom therefore ye ignorantly worship, him declare unto you." So listen, this is amazing. Did he start chapter and verse? No. He's like, look, guys, you guys have an issue. Let me illustrate it for you. I walked by, I saw this altar. Y'all are so afraid of leaving somebody out. You have an altar to, just in case you forgot a God, there's one to him. And he says, this God you don't know about is the God that I'm here to tell you about. Verse 24, "God that made the world and all things therein, seeing that he is Lord of heaven and earth, dwelleth not in temples made with hands." Boy, a lot of what he is preaching here is going against the mainstream thought of the religion of the day. You know, they really thought that these temples pleased the gods, that the gods, you know, not necessarily dwelt inside them, but that there was a presence and a power to them. And he's saying, look, God is bigger than that. He doesn't dwell in temples. This God that, you know, that this unknown God that, you know, that I serve, you know, he's bigger than that. He doesn't have to have temples. Verse 25, "Neither is worshipped with men's hands, as though he needed anything, seeing he giveth to all life and breath and all things." I like this. He's basically one-upping them. It's like, hey, you think your gods are powerful? They control the weather and the seasons. My God gave you all the life that you have. So forget your little, you know, traditions and stuff. You know, my God has got them all beat. You wouldn't be breathing right now if it wasn't for him. And he's saying, look, you know, he's not worshipped with men's hands. That's, you know, statues and temples and stuff, graven images. I like it, as though he needed anything. He's like, look, my God's so big, he doesn't need any of that stuff. He's not petty or so insecure or weak that, you know, he has to have a statue to remind us about him. Verse 26, "And hath made of one blood all nations of men for to dwell on all the face of the earth, and hath determined the times before appointed and the bounds of their habitation." So basically saying, look, my God is not just the God of my people. He's the God of everybody. Verse 27, "That they should seek," that's the people, "should seek the Lord, if haply they might feel after him and find him, though he be not far from every one of us." I like this. It's like, look, he's right there. If we would just find him, he's not going to be far from us. Do a study in the book of Psalms. I actually wrote a little poem. I kind of turned into a song about this, and it's not very good. But notice how many times in the book of Psalms David would write and say, "Be not far from me," and he's begging the Lord to be close to him. And at the same time, there's also plenty of times where it talks about God being close and God drawing near to you. So it really is what Paul's saying is, you know, God's not far off. God's right there. He's nearby. Verse 28, "For in him," that's in God, "we live and move and have our being, as certain also of your own poets have said, for we are also his offspring." It's very interesting what he does here. It's like, look, you know, we live because of God. We live in God. We exist because of God. And like this, does he quote the Bible? No, he quotes one of their own poets. And There's some debate, and in fact, I don't think people are really sure where that comes from. If it may be something lost to history, but I don't recall ever seeing this quote attributed. But basically, you know, even one of their guys was saying, you know, look, we're God's children, and and that it's amazing. You still hear that nowadays. Well, we're all God's children, so nothing new under the sun. Verse 29, forasmuch then as we are the offspring of God, we ought not to think that the Godhead is like unto gold or silver or stone graven by art and man's device. So he's like, look, you know, excuse me, if we are the children of God, what business do we have in creating God, in creating these idols and stuff? It's verse 30. And the times of this ignorance God winked at. So it's like God allowed it to happen is basically what he's saying. It's God allowed this to happen, this ignorance. It's not a new truth breaking out. It's just, look, you guys didn't know, you were ignorant of this, and God allowed it to happen. But, the key word there, but, now commandeth all men everywhere to repent. So he's like, look, God allowed that, but now it's time to get serious about this. Verse 31, because he hath appointed a day in the which he will judge the world in righteousness by that man whom he hath ordained. That man, of course, is Christ, whereof he hath given assurance unto all men, and that he hath raised him, Christ, from the dead. So, this is as far as he's going to get in the sermon, but basically he's saying, look, you better repent because there is a judgment day coming. And we know this because of the work and the ministry of Jesus Christ. And, you know, but you can have forgiveness through him. So as he starts to turn this, I can imagine everybody's kind of nodding their heads like, okay, we like this. He loses them right there because he brought up the resurrection, which is funny. It's amazing. That's even a sticking point with the Jews. The Sadducees didn't believe in it. And, you know, so that was already a fighting point amongst the Sadducees and the Pharisees. So verse 32, and when they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some mocked. So like some like, oh boy, that was good until that point. You're crazy, man. You think people raised from the dead? Don't you know, you know, after you're dead, your body rots and, you know, the soul doesn't exist or whatever they believed at the time. And it says, and others said, we will hear thee again of this matter. So like, this is interesting. We'd like to hear a little bit more, but the thing is with Oriental type culture and the Greek type culture, basically he lost the crowd right here, which is really amazing because usually they let people speak their piece. But the idea of the resurrection was so controversial that I think some people started making such a ruckus, like, oh man, this guy's an idiot. We don't need to listen to him. He's crazy. And he basically lost the crowd and no one could hear him. That's where everybody else like, look, oh boy, we're sorry for the other thing, but hey, stick around. We want to hear more about this. So verse 33, he's lost the crowd. They're not going to listen. He's lost the moment. So verse 33, so Paul departed from among them. But he did do some good, verse 34. Howbeit, certain men claved unto him and believed. Among them, the which was Dionysus, the Areopagite. And I'm butchering that, but basically it means he was a guy that hung around Mars Hill. And a woman named Damaris and others with them. So there we go. We wrap up with Paul really at the center of the Greek world, preaching the gospel and gaining an audience and winning people to his side. And we see people saved and believing in what he did. Now, like I said, there's so much we could go into how he presented the gospel to them. This was not a 1-2-3 pray after me deal. He didn't lead them down the Romans road. Of course, you know, I guess he hadn't wrote the Romans road yet, but, or maybe he had. Maybe I'm getting my time mixed up. But anyway, you know, he didn't go chapter and verse on. He went to prove them, to get them to say yes and agree with him. He built on the stuff they knew. He built on the stuff they understood, and laid the groundwork and just did an expert job. This is just an object lesson in and how to present an argument. In fact, I've read that that lawyers used to study in America used to study Paul's writings and Paul's sermons just to study his logic and how he would present an argument and defend it and present it, you know, and because he is so masterful at it. And he does such a tremendous job in setting up the idea of one God, of this one God being the God of all mankind, not just of one group or one city, but being the God of all mankind. Even touching to explain why the Greeks didn't know about him until now. And then to lay the groundwork to preach the gospel and talk about the coming judgment. And where does he lose them? When he brings up the resurrection. He had them all the way up to that point. What a tremendous sermon he does. And that's like, just shows you what a keen mind that Paul had. And really the education he has to be able to converse in such a manner with these philosophers and to present this in a style and in a way that they would listen to him. You know, it is a shame that Christianity today, for the most part, I'm not going to say they don't exist, but for the most part, our preachers and our leaders and our Christians in general cannot present their beliefs, can't even present the gospel without being robotic, without going through the same steps. Really, they don't try to meet the needs of the person. They just go down a script of what they know and what they believe. And, you know, I thank God that there are some men who get into, you know, what's called apologetics and defense of the faith. And, you know, guys, you know, even I may not agree with them totally in all the cases, but guys like Josh McDowell who can deal with that and can work to present, you know, present Christianity in such a way as to overcome all these doubts that an unsafe person would have and that an educated unsafe person would have. You know, I thank God not everybody's got that type of mind, not everybody's got that type of skill, but I tell you what, I wish that we all as Christians were able to present the gospel in an effective, meaningful way to people and to know our crowds and be able to reach the people. That's what Paul did right here. Did he preach? Is that the way he preached in the synagogues? Absolutely not. But he knew the crowd and he went to try to meet their needs and try to get in the only way he could. And that was through philosophy. If he had went and started trying to preach religion, they wouldn't listen to him. But he got to religion by starting out very philosophical and laying the groundwork that I'm not preaching anything new. Hey, you guys worship my God down there in that unknown God because you don't know about him. Now, let me tell you about that unknown God. Just what a tremendous, tremendous sermon. I really challenge you. Study this. Look at how he presents this argument. And I wish I had done a better job of really breaking this down. But just how he builds off of this, just the presence of that altar. And before you know it, in just a matter of a few verses, he's preaching Christ and he's preaching, you know, about the coming judgment. And so much is contained in those verses, so much great doctrine. And it's like he's not twisting anything. He's not changing anything. It's all good. It's all good, sound doctrine. But he is able to package it and present it in such a way that these Gentile and even in some cases, atheistic philosophers are able to sit there and take it in. He's able to plant the seed of the gospel in their minds. What a tremendous thing. I challenge you to study that. And unfortunately, that's about it for Paul's tenure in Athens. In our next lesson, he will be taking off to Corinth, and we will be wrapping up the second missionary journey there. Well, I appreciate you listening and putting up with me rambling, but I feel like we had a rough start in this one, but I think we ended pretty good. So anyway, I appreciate you listening today. Check out BaptistBasics.org when you get a chance, And we will see you in the next lesson. I'm Matthew Gage, and once again, I do sincerely thank you for listening, and I hope this has been a help and a blessing to you.